I had a perfect storm of very stressful things that happened. My wife's health got really quite bad, multiple days and stays in hospital, potential job losses, but we didn't know how many or when or who. And people were looking to me as the COO. That was just the last straw.
Why do you know you care a lot more?
Felt like I suffered a lot and I learned from that and I wanted to share with others. I realized I wanted to do something in this whole mental health space.
Brian Henderson,
award-winning influencer, educator, advocate, and ally in mental health and wellness.
As men, we are conditioned to be the provider, the strong one, to not show our emotions, to not show fear. And I just had this realization that men do not have many safe spaces where they can actually talk about whatever's going on for them.
We talk about women empowerment, but then we also acknowledge the labelings and the spectrum that actually drive motivation and bringing people together. What is the solution here? Is there one?
Someone once said to me, aim for the moon, and even if I don't make it, I might end up amongst the stars. 4.5 years ago, I got stuck. I made it my mission to spread positivity and help 1 million people to think differently. If you also believe that our world needs more positive energy, please join us on the journey. I'm Aaron Pang, and this is a Transformative Purpose.
Brian, welcome to the studio.
Thanks, Aaron. It's such a pleasure to be here.
I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I know we've been talking about it for a couple of months now. I'm super stoked that you're here. Also, as my first guest in this beautiful space, which is sponsored by Mix Studios.
Yeah, pleasure to be here. I know the friends at Mix Studios very well, so it's a real treat.
It's a small world, isn't it?
Yeah, it's small.
Okay, I'm going to kick off with something super straightforward. Why are you here, Brian? Why do you do, your current line of work?
Oh, it's such a great question, and it's been a long journey. Why do I do it? It's because it comes from the heart, I guess. But the journey, in very summary level, I've worked in law firms for the longest time, nearly 30 years, most recently as a chief operating officer in one of the biggest international firms in Asia. And I had a perfect storm of very stressful things that happened. So my wife's health got really quite bad, which affected her in many ways, including her physical and mental health. Multiple days and stays in hospital. We decided to buy a very expensive flat in Hong Kong. Very stressful. We had a big restructuring at work, potential job losses, but we didn't know how many or when or who. And people were looking to me as the COO for answers on that. Then I obviously we had the social unrest and the COVID, and then I had a new boss. And I'd had my previous boss for 8 years. We'd worked very closely, and I didn't have the same relationship with the new boss, and that was just the last straw in a way for me. And so I was just feeling really exhausted. I had upset tummy the whole time. I could sleep for 2.5 to 3 hours a night, and that was it. So I went to my family doctor and I said, look, I just cannot sleep and my tummy is just dreadful. And so she said, okay, well, I can give you some medication for the sleep and we can have some investigations, see what's happening with the tummy. And then she said, but do you think you'd benefit from seeing a psychiatrist? And I thought, oh my God, like I nearly cried with relief. Because up until that point, I hadn't realized that actually my real problem was a mental health problem. And so I had medication for that, antidepressants, and I had some talk therapy. And in the end, it's still the relationship with the boss was just that not really going to work, given where I was at the time and given where he needed to go as the new guy wanting to make an impact. So we agreed just to part company, and I spent about 18 months recovering from that experience and finding my way. And as I found my way, I realized I wanted to do something in this whole mental health space, particularly around burnout, particularly with senior executives, because I felt like I suffered a lot and I learned from that suffering experience and I wanted to share with others. So they can notice if they're going in that direction, or we can help them to avoid ending up there. So there was a lot of some physical work around getting back into my exercise regime, picking my yoga back up again, just getting outdoors, and a lot of inner work, journaling, meditating, creative expression, all sorts of different things. So
and I went to one of your yoga sessions.
Yeah, that's not fair.
A long journey. So I'm not a qualified yoga teacher. I'm doing a meditation teacher training at the moment. So I'm really enjoying that reconnection with a sort of sense of spirituality.
So would you say you're fully recovered? You mentioned the recovery is talk about 18 months, right? And when did you decide to open up with your vulnerability? Was it after everything's done, everything's like blue sky, you got clear mind, or did you open up some way along the line?
The opening up was actually part of the recovery process. So I was very fortunate. I had the partner of a good friend of mine is a journalist, freelance journalist. And through her partner, she heard about my experience. And she reached out and said, "Brian, I really want to tell your story." And so we kind of worked that through. And she wrote this beautiful article, which got published in the South China Morning Post. And that was probably within 3 or 4 months of leaving work. So far, far from being fully recovered, but I did find it very cathartic to tell my story and then to experience the sort of very positive and supportive reaction that you get. So, you know, that was also very helpful in feeling like, okay, I am being validated here. Okay, I've shared this experience. I put myself out there. I've been vulnerable. But people are not shooting me down, saying, "Oh, you loser, you're so weak. Come on, get your act together." They were saying, "Wow, I'm so glad you shared that, because I have felt some part of that that resonates in some way with me," or "there, but for the grace of God, I could have been in that place too."
So what are some of the incremental tools that you suggest people to try? And whether it is meditation, yoga, I was wondering, you know, 18 months, quite a long time. How did that feel? How did those 18 months feel for you? What was it, a linear path? You know, you knew all the tools in your head that you're going to try all of them. How was the learning journey for you there?
Yeah. Well, I think it was a journey of exploration and experimentation. So I certainly didn't know what the recovery path would be. You know, I just knew that I could not go back into that sort of work environment. And when I think about that, sometimes I still get triggered. So something triggered me the other day about that work environment, and I had a little mini panic attack, which totally out of the blue, and the trigger was nothing at all. I mean, really, the reaction was out of all proportion. So, you know, there's still some sort of latent trauma in my experience somewhere. But no, it was really baby steps. The first few weeks was just sleep, rest, sit on my balcony, look out the window, you know, kind of, yeah, relaxing, trying to relax as best I could. I felt a lot of anger and frustration and disappointment. And
what were you just swayed up about?
Should I have done better? Should I have seen this coming? Could I have done things differently? You know, why me? Why now? You know, so some sort of regret, because I felt, well, I've still got some great, interesting projects to work on here. Lovely stuff that I could have been doing. And when you spend 30 years getting to, like, I felt like the pinnacle of my career, the job I had was my dream job since 20 years before, probably, which I'd been working towards. And so there was a sense of loss, there's a sense of grief, actually, for that loss. So very, very complex emotions that I found really hard to deal with. So I think the initial phase, when I reflect back, it was probably kind of more distraction in a way. So I took up sketching, which I used to do when I was a kid at school. I was like top of the art class, you know, so I just took up drawing. I tried learning Cantonese, just again to use a different part of the brain and stimulate myself in a different way.
How pretty is the gas is now?
It's extremely bad.
The point was just to use a different part of my brain and try and, you know,
make it more house.
Exactly, just make it more plastic. So we're trying to work. And then journaling, I found that extremely helpful for a while, just trying to write down whatever was on my mind. So it was no longer on my mind, it was just on the page or in the iPad. And then intentionally reconnecting with friends, just going out, having a chat, having a coffee. And as I said, like I'd been so, 3 hours sleep a night, you know, normally I get up to do my sport early morning, 6 a.m. or 5 a.m. You just cannot do that if you've been awake since 2 a.m. already. So gradually picking up my exercise regime, I found that helpful. And then a little further down the track in came the yoga. A friend of mine was offering, I think this was at the start of COVID, an online yoga program. And it was basically 20 minutes a day, and it was a 9-week program every day for 9 weeks. And it was a very mindful way of teaching yoga. It was all about inner exploration, inner peace, figuring out what does my body need today? Not what is my teacher giving me, but what do I personally need? So that I found really, really helpful. And then I got more and more curious and interested in that mindful meditation part and started learning more and then getting apps about meditation. You know, I've been on meditation retreats and qualifying as a yoga teacher. So all of those things, they kind of evolved. They were just experiments. Some things worked better than others. I no longer do the sketching so much. I journal occasionally, but not so frequently as I used to. And I found the yoga and the meditation are more my daily practice and walking my dog and doing my sport.
Yeah, beautiful. You touch on different phases of your recovery processes as I'm hearing it. So there's the awareness, right? Awareness of the situation. There was a bit of a blame game, victim, why me, why now? I'm worth so long, right? You got to your gym, dream job, there's so much more you could have done. Could have done more, right? And then, I guess slowly, and then you slowly work your way through, and then it's acceptance, right? Was it a linear path?
Never. No, I mean, you know, life comes in waves. We have our ups and downs, and yeah, one step forward, one step back. You know, but I think, like, directionally, there was an upward trend, for sure. And I think when I realized that I probably had really recovered pretty much fully was, you know, part of what I was doing was sharing my lived experience, talking about mental health. What are the signs? What are the symptoms? How do you notice what's going on? And this conversation about what do you do to help yourself recover? So I've been talking about anxiety and depression with a major employer here in Hong Kong. And at the end of the session, somebody came up to me and said, "Oh, Brian, you know, that was a really difficult subject, but you just brought so much positive energy to it." And I thought, wow. You're right. I did. I didn't even notice, but you're right.
But it's fascinating. Sometimes you underestimate how much our struggles could mean something to someone else. I'm doing. Who's going through the same process? Who's lacking tools? Lacking the inner circle of friends that they can share with?
I'm glad you mentioned that. So part of my recovery journey actually also was setting up mental health peer support groups. So one of my friends said to me, "Brian, it'd be really helpful to have a group of people where we can just talk about our struggles." So then I worked with another friend who had experience of working in a peer support group with a psychiatrist supervising. And so we just created that Friends of Friends, people we kind of had in our networks. And that's been going now for 3.5 years. And that just sharing your experience and hearing other people's stories and realizing, you know what? I'm not so different, so special, so unique, or so terrible. We're all, many of us, experiencing something similar. In the environment you're creating there, which is helping support the healing, is there's no judgment, there is validation, there's empathy, there's compassion. So that I found so, so helpful. And I think in Hong Kong, it's something which, you know, is chronically undersupplied. I think there are certainly people running support groups of that nature, but, you know, we could do 100 times and still not be meeting the need actually for supporting people.
What advice would we give to people who feel like, you know, they are still in their shell, you know, doing that, you know, you were in that state where you felt like there's so much more, you worked so hard to get to that stage, but felt like everything was taken away from you. Not by choice, but more mentally. What advice would you give to people to break down the shell, right? People are feeling sorry for themselves, so feeling they're the victim of the situation. How could they think differently?
So a few things that worked for me. Self-compassion, I think, is really important. So just acknowledging that, yes, this is painful. Yes, I'm feeling some sense of suffering. And just being kind with yourself, like sort of giving yourself mentally or even physically a bit of a hug, that can really help. Another thing which I found, I thought it was a little corny, before, which is the whole positive affirmation thing. I'm going to get through an exercise of writing out, well, what are some of the positive things about me that I really appreciate? And I came up with, I can't remember maybe off the top of my head, but it was something like, I'm a big-hearted, loving, kind guy, something like that.
Roundtable.
Yeah, just loving, kind, compassionate. That's me. That's the core. It's the essence of who I am. And I could just repeat that to myself and feel, you know what? Yeah, that really is the core of the essence of who I am. And that reconnection with, if you like, with the soul, that element of spirituality, I found really, actually, that was quite transformative.
Did you always believe in all those things?
Well, I think I've always, yes, I've always felt like kindness and compassion. You know, I was always one of those love and peace sort of 1970s hippies that kind of always appealed to me, that ethos. So I think that has, you know, insofar as anything has been consistent through life, those sort of core values, I think, have always been there. And they probably manifested in different ways at different times. And for sure, at times when I was super stressed, you know, expressing love or compassion would have been difficult, if not impossible, at certain phases. But, you know, when I looked deep inside, I think that core was always there. So, you know, and I distinguish that from religion. So I was brought up in a religious family, went to church every week. And you have a degree of faith if you believe. But with most religions, or maybe all religions, there's also some sort of dogma. You must do it this way. There's only one right way, and you must believe in
11
this.
points of data.
So, you know, so spirituality, I think, is about that sense of I'm whole, I am good enough, and I am not alone. I am somehow connected to people around me, to the community I live in, to the world, to the universe, whatever way you like to think about it. But there has to be something more than my small, disconnected, lonely self. So that sort of spirituality in that sense I find super uplifting and very helpful. And I mean, in life, and you know, if you want to do challenging work, you need to have that sense of connection. And certainly as part of my mental health recovery journey, it also was extremely helpful.
I like to think that everyone needs to have hope, but whether it is coming from Malaysia or coming from something, you need to find out where's your source of hope. But because if you lose that, it's very hard to allow yourself, right?
It's great.
And life is challenging, as we all know. There's one common destination that we all reach there. But then for our life, we all have the same struggles. We just struggle with the same thing during different time stamps, pretty much, right? And really admire all the work that you're doing. I know, I think I believe your community is called Movement.
So Movement, so there's a number of things that are coming together with Movement. So I'm also a board member of the Women's Foundation, which is a feminist NGO supporting women and girls in Hong Kong. And many years ago now, I helped them to set up a male ally program. So we felt, well, predominantly leadership groups are still comprised of men, majority men. So if we want to see meaningful change in organizations, we actually have to engage with those men and help them understand gender equity, perhaps from a different perspective that they don't have. So as men, we tend to enjoy a lot of privilege, and we have a lot of blind spots about how the female experience is so different from ours because the women don't have that privilege. So part of what we teach the allies on that program, in addition to all the bias and microaggressions and how to call out inappropriate behavior and all of that stuff, is a section on masculinities. So as men, we are conditioned to be the provider and the protector of our families, to be the strong one, to not show our emotions, to not show fear, etc. Acceptable emotional expression is anger, frustration, you know, but love, compassion, kindness, anything soft.
I'm sure it's all right.
So, and then as I had my own mental health journey, and of course, I've been doing my yoga and meditation, and I just had this realization that men do not have many safe spaces where they can actually talk about whatever's going on for them. Very hard to talk to. I didn't talk to my partner about my mental health struggles. I didn't talk to my mum about it because I was feeling a lot of shame about that and feeling like, I don't want to put that on them. That's going to be, they don't want to hear that. That's going to be painful for them. So, so I kept it to myself. And I think a lot of guys probably are like that. And the research shows that men get less support and treatment in the clinical side than women do for their mental health because they don't ask for help, because they feel a sense of shame. So, MoveMen is not aimed at guys with mental health problems. It's just aimed at guys like you and me are now perfectly normal and functioning, but maybe we've got some stresses, maybe we've got some relational difficulties, maybe we're struggling to be the parent that we want to be for our kids. Maybe our career is a little bit off track or we're a bit anxious about that. So just stuff. So MoveMen is basically movement, meditation, and mindful dialogue for people who identify as male. And we just create a safe space where they can start to explore, how does my anger show up and how do I typically react when I have those little relational frustrations? Where does that energy go? So a lot of guys, there might be a lot of shouting and yelling. For other guys, they might just bottle it up and then they realize, oh, well, my shouting and yelling is just hurting my relationship and this stuckness is hurting me. One way or the other, neither is going to be healthy. So that's the kind of stuff that we work with the movement.
I want to ask you a question about the people, I guess the men that you're coming across who need help, who need to have this safe space to get help, get support from other peers. Do you see more introverts than extroverts, or is there a balance? Have you noticed any characteristics of amongst the people that are coming to your community?
Yeah, what a great question. I hadn't thought of that. I suspect on balance, more introverts, probably more reflective types. I was expecting to get sort of 40 to 60-year-olds, kind of the classic mid-ish life crisis sort of level.
I'm turning 40 next one. Okay.
But in fact, we've got guys that have like recently retired and they're working through what is my new life? I don't know who I am or where I'm going anymore. And I've actually got 20-year-olds, astonishingly, which I really was not expecting. So my Women's Foundation work, we also have a Young Allies program for university students. And so I have a little bit of network in that area as it happens. And so I'm now getting these young guys turning up and Cantonese guys as well as expats. So I'm quite surprised by that range of very different types of age profile, certainly. The different ethnic backgrounds is also really rewarding. And the last time we met, we had a couple of people doing their sharing in Cantonese, which I thought wonderful. I really would love to get some there are Cantonese speaking groups together if I can find a person to help facilitate. So yeah, but you're right, probably there is certainly a lot of reflection. The kind of I mean, I talk about strength and vulnerability. So guys are kind of attuned to strength, that's a positive, and yeah, that's a guy thing. And vulnerability is kind of like a, I don't know, is that strength? Maybe, I'm not sure, but they want to explore. So they're curious enough to know that there's something they could do better, they could be better in themselves somehow. So they have that curiosity, and then we just work with that curiosity in this safe environment.
Can I slick a point on labels? I think everyone needs to be mindful of the labels that the society has put on us. And the definitions of those labels might not be true. It all comes down to how you interpret that label. To someone, vulnerability is a weakness. But to someone, when you use vulnerability with good intention, it can be a source of strength.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, great point on labels. I mean, labels are a way of creating separation. Okay, you are that. Therefore, there's some difference. Like, that is different from me. I'm not that. So labels really create division. And you see it, Republican, Democrat, whatever way. You see it everywhere. So yeah, I agree. Labels are really quite damaging. And working in the diversity world as well, I've got a friend who's the COO of a law firm like me, and I happen to know he was gay, and I've met his partner, and privately he's very open about that. And once towards the end of our respective careers, I said to him, like, why have you never been more of an advocate on the LGBT side? And he said, well, Brian, I didn't want to be known as the chief gay. And I thought, Fair enough, right? You do not want to be labeled that way. That is part of your identity, but it's only a small part. And he has all these other identities. So I thought, great, yeah, I can understand if you don't want to be labeled. Of course, none of us like to be labeled because that will only ever be one little part of who we really are.
I have a rather unpopular question. I'm experiencing a dilemma, right? So I've been, you know, doing this podcast for 2.5 years now, and one of the suggestions that I often get is, why don't you pick an audience? Why don't you pick an audience? Because I'm a father, I've got two kids. Why don't you just go aside with dads? And then you talked about women and empowerment, and that is sort of true. I think most leadership positions, we don't globally, is still dominated by males. And then we see the emergence of women of foundation, you know, a lot of women empowerment initiatives. Now we slowly see the men issues, like the one that you're driving. But then we've also acknowledged with the labelings and the spectrum and the extremes, and actually drive more division than bringing people together. What is the solution here? Is there one?
Well, so quick fix, one size fits all solutions are always a big trap, I think we all fall into. So, you know, we have a sense of compassion. I can see a problem that I want to try and solve, and I want to try and fix it. So I want to find a solution. But often the world is complex and adaptive. And so whatever I do to that system is going to have results that I cannot envisage and predict. And they may cause more harm than I expect, you know, for sure. So I think we always have to be very, very careful of the solution, because in complexity there is no easy solution. So it's always a moving towards, it's an evolution, it's an experimentation. So with the male allies, for example, to use that as a little mini case study, we started with men only. And I always felt quite uncomfortable about that, because I felt like, well, we don't really know what we're talking about, right? We're a bunch of men, we don't know what the female experience is. So I lobbied and lobbied and lobbied for a few years, and eventually we got to a point where we said, okay, let's have female allies. They could be allies to other women, or they can be allies to their men who want to learn more about this topic. So we now have women on the program as allies. And that is so much more constructive, because the guys tend to get a little bit ahead of themselves. Oh, I think I understand this. And the woman will say, no, you don't. Actually, this is what you're missing still. And then, you know, it is still a very binary male or female thing. So what do we do with our, you know, intersex or people who don't identify necessarily as male or female, or gender fluid? You know, so, you know, we do try to embrace that as well. So I very carefully said identify as male earlier. So you may not be, cisgender. Which is fine. So I think trying to be as inclusive as we can, and just being conscious that we do all have our biases, and that it is so easy to start applying labels to people, but that is always going to create some sort of separation, some sort of distance. It's not going to encourage a sense of inclusion and belonging. But I think if you can be aware of it, you can be more open to, oh yeah, I just made an assumption, or I just put someone in a box, and maybe there's more to that person than my assumption or that box.
I want to talk about stress management. It is going to be another challenging year. Many people have been laid off. You mentioned, you touched on anxiety, stress, and you had a high profile position at a global law firm. I want to ask you any advice and tips you can give hundreds of people who are suffering at work, the controllable things and the uncontrollable things. How do you manage your stress, and how do you manage your response to that in a highly volatile and uncertain environment?
So I'll do a sort of, if you like, before and after. So before I really started struggling, multiple ways I would manage my stress. So get some exercise, get outdoors, even at lunchtime for 10 or 15 minutes, get some sunshine, get some vitamin D, even in the winter, just take your sandwich, just go for a walk, take a friend, have a chat, walk and talk. take breaks. So go to the water cooler, wander around the corridor, bump into people, have random chats. Make sure you have a date night with your partner, or meet a friend for a
Yeah, we'll talk about that. Every Thursday, guys. Every Thursday, I go out with my wife.
You know.
Yeah, unless one of us is sick, we will do that date night ritual. We drop everything. We'll not get wasted anything, especially water. Because, I've got two young boys now, 5 and 2.5. And I think parenting is one of those things that I think education is, right?
Yeah.
We all aspire to be a different parent because of, our experience as a child. But a lot of these experiences actually leave in our default. As much as we want to be different, for me, sometimes the ugly side does come out, right? And yeah, I just want to say, date night ritual and just setting boundaries, super, super important. Some people, when they think they spend time with their spouse, very often they are giving their remaining self to their spouse. They prioritize the needs of the children first. They go to work. They come home after dinner, spend time, do bedtime story with the kids. And then they sit on the couch with the spouse, watching Netflix.
Yep.
That is not quality time spending with your spouse.
Correct. Guilty.
All comes out in balance.
Right. Yeah, guilty, absolutely.
So yeah, I mean the bedtime ritual, same, like no phone in the bedroom, never, always put it on a charger in a different room. Don't use the phone as my alarm clock, so I'm not picking my phone up and going straight on the email. I drink some water, stretch, wander around, make a cup of tea, and then once I've had some breakfast, then I might get on the email. So yeah, so those are all the things that I work. I mean, they worked for me for 30 years, right? Pretty well. To greater degrees, sometimes I was doing a lot of sport, probably because I was compensating for a lot of stress. And other times didn't do so much. But the thing is, if you're living in a very, very stressful environment for an extended period of time, and you're not managing your stress well, or even if you're still doing all of those things, you just build up these levels of cortisol that get to a point where actually you can no longer calm down. Because all of those relaxation techniques, they're just trying to reduce the stimulation of the sympathetic nervous system. So trying to press down those kind of more activating hormones, fight or flight, and get you into the rest and digest. But after a certain point, and certainly what I found was that I just could not switch off ever, because I'd got to that point where it was just so much stress that whatever I was doing in terms of getting out for my little walks or whatever just didn't work anymore. And that is a big, big, big red flag, that you need professional help. And I didn't notice that red flag. I mean, I even went to a lunch and learn about anxiety and depression where they described all the symptoms, and I went tick, 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 bingo card, full house. And I said to my colleague sitting next to me, "I think I've got all those symptoms." And she said, "Yeah, me too." So we thought, well, it must be normal then. So we both went back to work. So I think that's very dangerous. That was a big mistake that I made, and I see so many of my friends make the same mistake. I mean, they'll come and ask me and say, "Look, I feel really burned out." And I ask them, "Well, what are you doing about it?" And the answer is always nothing. Yeah, so that's when you need professional help. If your normal coping and relaxation strategies are not working, then you do need to go and see your doctor and maybe get some therapy, maybe have some medication. But yeah, definitely get it checked.
So all comes down to balance,
Yeah.
right? And try to intervene early and not wait till late.
Very hard to do. I mean, another feature of this journey into depression and anxiety is that you don't actually you lose your self-awareness. So you're not really aware of the extent to which you're struggling. Unfortunately for me, because I was like the big boss, nobody was giving me any feedback until the day I handed my notice in, and I thought, oh gosh, I've got to tell my PA, who I love to bits, and she kind of managed to get me through the last, 6 months when I was struggling. And she said, she came bouncing in and she said, "Oh, I heard the news." But I was going, "What? How did you hear the news?" And she said, "I'm so happy for you because you've been so miserable for so long." I was very,
Why the hell didn't you know you 6 months later? Oh, speaking of authenticity, right? How did it? Why can't people just be more honest and just authentic and just say what they think?
Yeah,
Right?
and
I've spoken to so many And I think I'm one of those that sometimes I can come across as too direct, right? Assertive, maybe a better word. But I truly believe that you do have the heart, your heart for the other person. If you truly mean well for the other person, if you see the other person struggle, you should say something.
Yeah.
Right? And you go out drinking and you see your friend beach drinking, try to not pay. I think as an authentic friend, you should really just voice out and say, hey, what's wrong? Maybe a little too much.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, and that's not an easy thing to do. And it's there's some great work on that. Brené Brown does some great work on that. And there's a doctor called Catherine Mannix. And her book is called Listen, Finding the Words for Tender Conversations. I would recommend to your audience. And they talk about these compassionate conversations. And what they're saying is that you need to be curious, you need to stay with them, and you need to help them to tell their story, right? So it's not about you. So are you okay? Oh, that sounds awful, but you know, I've had this.
I'm not scared. I feel making it like myself. No.
Or if their story starts to get really uncomfortable, maybe you're finding it a bit triggering, it's very easy to steer that away somewhere else and say, oh, well, you know, I'm sorry, I've got to run, but yeah. So staying with your own discomfort at their suffering, it's actually not an easy thing to do. So again, all of this is really helped and strengthened by mindfulness practices. So staying curious, staying engaged, staying with them, helping them to tell their story, not allowing your own reaction to their story to divert, you know, the attention away from what they need. And that if you're able to do that, it's massively therapeutic. You know, so when I had people tell me, oh, Brian, just calm down, I'm like,
Whoa, it's really austere.
Whereas if I have people who say, oh, wow, Brian, you know, I've noticed that you're getting quite irritable. I notice that you're late for meetings. I notice that you seem to be whatever. You know, would you like to share what's going on? And maybe I'm ready to share, maybe I'm not. So don't take it personally if I say maybe another time. But give them the opportunity and show that you care and let them know that if you ever do want to have a chat or if you do feel ready, you're there for them. And also accept that you might not be the right person. Maybe I just don't feel safe enough with you, but maybe there is someone else. You can always say, look, if there is someone else you feel you can talk to, maybe it would be worth reaching out. So I think that is so important. So that, are you okay? People feel like, yeah, I've done my duty, I've checked in. And the answer is always, yeah, I'm okay.
And he's definitely some like,
Ibrahim, nothing.
Right. How are you? That's the one we use those questions.
What's going on for you? This one, my
life is all it's going on for you. But yeah, what are you struggling with? How can I help? How can I be of service?
CL.
And the one that I use with my peer support group is a 1 to 10 scale. So, how are you today? You know, 1 is I need emergency help, and 10 is I've never felt better in my life. You know, and we get a spectrum from maybe 3 or maybe even had a 2 up to 8 or 9. But you can very quickly see, okay, yeah, this person needs a bit more time and attention. And I'm going to have to go slow here because there's a lot going on for them. So there's lots of different techniques to help engage in that conversation. And there's quite a lot of skill in creating that sense of, I'm here to support you because I care about you. I'm not going to judge you, whatever you tell me. I'm not going to react with shock or dismay or judgmental kind of reactions. And I want to help you find your own solution. So I'm not going to impose a solution. I'm not going to try and fix you. But whatever help you need, of course, I will help you find it.
Yeah. And this is a point about being interested in that. Yeah, trying to be interesting.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Let's shift gear a bit and talk about self-improvement. Right. Yeah. What's your view on self-improvement? Should that be our focus?
I think it is something that is deeply conditioned socially. We're often felt, you know, brought up to feel like you should be better. You should be getting higher grades. You should be in the A team. You should be doing more. You should have a bigger job or a sexier job title or a fancier car or a prettier partner, better looking, whatever. So I think society, and particularly since the advent of social media, you know, with the very out of reach, unrealistic portrayals of what perfect should be, you know, we're all chasing after some sort of perfection. And we are perfect. We are born perfect, right? You know, we're born with a heart and a soul. We're born with the ability to love. And those are the conditions you need to be happy. So this conditioning about you're not enough and you need to do more in order to be happy. Okay, so it's making happiness conditional on something. And it's up. And once you've ticked a few of the things off, then there's always something else that you need to make you happy. Like there's a crazy big sailing yacht in the bay on the side, and it even has a little helicopter on the back. And you kind of wonder, I wonder if the people on that boat are happy, actually, right? Because they've got everything they could possibly want from a financial point of view.
I did those studies some years ago, and I think what they found, and this is a study done in the US, and they found a threshold around $70,000 US. And basically what happens if you earn about that threshold, happiness sort of plateaus, yep, and it drops them.
Correct.
Exactly. So, you know, so I think we all have what we need to be happy within us. And so, you know, what am I striving to be better in some way? Probably. I mean, I practice my yoga, I practice my meditation. But all I'm trying to do is to find some sort of sense of balance, some sort of sense of peace, some sort of equanimity, you know, so that I can cope with my daily struggles. Like my partner self is still not great. We've got another issue that we're dealing with at the minute. But my mindfulness and my meditation really helps me to retain some sense of equanimity, which allows me to be present for her. You know, so when she needs me, I can be fully present there for her. And then I need to go away and do a lot of work to rebuild my own energy, because it can be quite draining. So yeah, so I think the self-improvement in the sense of you should be better because you're not enough is potentially very toxic. And if you had come to me when I was in my darkest place and said, Brian, you need to transform yourself into a life coach or something, it would have just sent me into a tailspin, because I was already feeling really inadequate, really like a failure, and that would have been just way beyond what I was capable of in that moment. So you also have to be very mindful of where people are starting from in terms of their own well-being and wholeness.
Fascinating. It is such an important point about drawing this distinction about why are you trying to improve yourself? Is it because you're comparing yourself with someone else, comparing yourself with the people that you see on social media, which only show me the good side, or are you trying to improve just sort of betterment of yourself so that you can become a better person and inspire people? And I think the reason for improving is quite important.
Yeah, it really is. And you know, I've come to believe that, you know, if I can be okay in myself and you know, I can transmit that sense of, you know, I'm okay to you. And so if I'm in a space and you can sense that I'm okay, you know, you will start to feel like, oh, it's possible to be okay. Maybe okay is a normal state for human beings to be in. You know, and so there's this ripple effect as well. So I don't have to intentionally try and fix you or make you better. If I work on myself, people will notice that.
Yeah, because we get a sense to energy.
You sense the energy, you can see the healthy glow, you can feel that sense of peace and tranquility, and you can think, oh, that's achievable. Yeah. And you can aspire to that. But it doesn't mean you need to get a top PT in town and get a whole bunch of apps. You've got to, like I said, experiment and explore and figure out, you know, what it is that you need.
Yeah. To what extent did your corporate career help you or hinder your growth? Was it a catalyst to what you experienced? But what's your, I would like to know, like, what was your relationship with work then, and what is your relationship with work now?
Yeah, so I think work can be, it cuts both ways. For sure, I had plenty of great learning experiences, some great relationships, you know, stuff I'm very proud of, people I'm still in touch with. So yeah, so work can definitely be uplifting. In fact, the workplace should be somewhere where you thrive. It's about learning, it's about growing, it's about developing, it's about connecting, it's about doing something meaningful. But in many workplaces, it's not like that. And if it's driven by management by fear or with a lot of anxiety present, with a lack of psychological safety, with a lack of inclusion and belonging. I mean, law firms, by the way, are by structurally exclusive, right? You're a lawyer or you're not. And if you're not a lawyer, you're called a non-lawyer. You're a partner or you're not. So there's this little cabal of partners who control everything. And if you're not a partner, you're not. So it's structurally exclusive. And I think everybody who's not a partner, and maybe even some of the more junior partners, they definitely all feel that. Like, my tenure here is totally dependent on those people. I have no control. So so those are, you know, those are some of my observations on the workplace. Can definitely should be a place where people can thrive. It's about creating the right culture. And to create the right culture, my strong belief is the leaders have to have done some sort of inner work, you know, so they can explore their own biases, their own privilege, their own ways of being, how they typically react when they're under pressure or stressed or triggered. You know, how much perspective they can take, how much they notice, right now I'm feeling the need to fix, I'm feeling the need to dominate, I'm feeling the need to show my power, because actually I'm feeling a little insecure, I just need a little bit of love, or I just need a little bit of respect, or whatever. So so I think it really is, it really behoves all leaders to do the inner work that they need to do so that they can be okay. I'm okay. Okay. Yes, I've got this title as a leader, and that comes with a lot of responsibility and a lot of pressure. But I need to be aware if I'm putting that on other people, or whether I'm actually okay with that and got what I need to work with it, and to make sure that others are therefore also able to do their best work.
I'm curious, Ryan, how would you go about redesigning a toxic law firm? The power.
Yeah,
what would you do today? How would you be beside it?
That stuff's up.
I have a confession, which is that after 30 years of trying, I've given up. because these things are often, you see it in many organizations, but the ones that make the most business tend to rise to the top. So they may be technically very strong, therefore they have a good client following. They may be very good at their clients, maybe very good at client relationship management, but they can be extremely hard on themselves. They tend to be perfectionists. They tend to have a little bit of insecurity. They tend to have a slightly fragile ego. So negative criticism they take very badly. And then they transmit that there to their team. So very hard, very demanding. You know, I had to suffer through to get to where I am. So, you know, I'm going to pass that on. So it's a bit like the parenting thing. Except they don't even try to be better parents. They just give you those barrels. And those people tend to gravitate to the top, and they are about the worst sort of leader you could possibly create, unfortunately. And they have dark fire kind of personality disorders, many of them, honestly. And the research also shows that. So I think it's almost impossible to change that. So if you are a dark fire personality, that is one of the hardest things for any psychologist to work with to try and fix. In fact, you cannot really, unless the individual really wants to do the hard work, because they are sort of dissociated from their sense of self. So I think, honestly, I think it is extremely, extremely hard to change. It really does require like a collective accountability by the partners who are in charge of that law firm to say, do you know what? We are not going to tolerate this sort of behavior. I don't care how much you bill. If you're abusing your people, we're just going to have a problem recruiting and hiring. We're not going to be able to retain good people. Eventually, that will catch up with us in terms of our market reputation. And it's not healthy. So unless as a collective, you're willing to say, yeah, there is a boundary here that we're not willing to cross. If you can get that collective agreement and actually enforce it, then I think you could potentially make some progress, but that would be pretty hard in most law firms to do that.
But it is possible to get that critical mass.
It is, and there are plenty of law firms out there that don't have that culture, actually, where people are supportive and kind. And some of my clients are, I do actually have client law firms that are like that, where there's a lot of, you know, compassion. Maybe there's a few people that struggle to manage their frustrations and anxieties. But on balance, they are caring and supportive workplace. So So yeah, I'm painting the caricature, but you know, it's certainly possible to be other ways. It's just quite hard to change the toxic one into the more thriving one.
How people measure what influence their behaviors, right? And the concept of balanced scorecard, that we usually have four dimensions. We have the financial with the customers, we have the process, and then we have the learning and development. Is it possible to add a human measure into the balanced scorecard?
Yes. I think it's not only possible, I think it's essential. And I have friends who are listed company board directors or non-execs who have been pushing for that for quite a long time. So somebody like Mei Tan, who's on a number of boards in Hong Kong, a guy called Chris Brook, who's also been chairman of the rugby union, and he's on the Link REIT board. You know, people like that, they have been saying we need to measure wellness and we need to be setting some sort of KPI around wellness. And then the implementation becomes tricky because often people use engagement. Everybody has an engagement survey, are employees engaged? And they take that as a proxy for wellness, which it is not. You know, it's kind of quite sort of close, but it's not. It's like a false friend. Yeah, so I also work with a platform called Unmind, and they do try to measure directly people's levels of mental wellness by asking them questions, which they fill in every couple of weeks if they choose to. And then you can feed that back through a dashboard to the leadership team or HR or whoever needs to see it. And you can divide it by division or location. So you can narrow down pretty well who's got an environment where their team are thriving in terms of well-being and who does not. And then what do you do with that information? Then of course that can be challenging. So maybe it is the leader's fault or maybe there's something else going on. So don't assume it's just the leader's fault and just fire them on the spot. You've got to go investigate. Work with that leader to find out, well, what is the story here? What is going on? This is what the data is showing. Let's talk about it. But it's entirely possible to measure. It's entirely possible to set KPIs. It's entirely possible to set a culture where this is just information that is helpful and we all aspire to work with it, learn from it, and get better. So maybe that leader needs themselves to have a break. You know, maybe they need a bit more support. Maybe they need some more training. Maybe they've just been asked to take on too many projects and they haven't been able to say no because they're not good at managing their boundaries. You know, so you have to have a bit of empathy and compassion also for those leaders who are also extremely stressed. Like I mentioned before, 70% of leaders want to quit their job for better work-life balance. So I think there's also, we all tend to blame or find a scapegoat. So blame the bosses, blame the partners, but they have their own stresses. They have their own pressures. They've got to make their numbers. They've got the board on their back. Behind the board, they've got the shareholders. And unfortunately, we are all probably shareholders in the sense that we have maybe some, if we have any kind of savings at all, so that'll be invested in a fund. The fund will be buying shares in this company. And then this company is expected to deliver returns. And therefore the execs are pressured with that. So in fact, we all create this environment, which none of us like. Right? None of us like that pressure and that stress and that tension. But in a way, it's because we all feel like I need to have that return on my savings so I can retire safe and comfortable one day. You know, so again, that is conditional happiness that's driving all of that.
Yeah, and leadership for a lot of leaders is a lonely journey, right? And I think we touched on that early on about men feel more safe about sharing their peers, and the higher you climb, the less people you feel you can share with, because I think, let's be honest here, I think we get a lot of corporates, many of them are very transactional. It's a dog-eat-dog type culture. And I feel like there are a lot of people, men and women included, that are suffering in silence. So I think I like your point, you know, is there's never a one-size-fits-all solution. At the end of the day, I think it's all the individuals coming together and co-creating the holistic solution. And so it benefits the well-being of every single person in an organization occurring.
Yeah, which is exactly what I do in my day job now. So we have a tool which will evaluate resilience. So it's basically a burnout assessment tool. So it'll tell you on a scale from 0 to 100 how burned out you are, what your risk is. But you can then aggregate that for a whole team. And what I love about that is you can then reflect back to the team and say, okay, this is your experience. This is how your stress is manifesting. And the reaction I almost invariably get is, oh, I thought it was just me that was struggling, but actually seems like we're all struggling. Okay, hello, we all have similar biology. We're all in the same environment. We're all facing the same stressors, and yeah, it does show up in a similar way for all of us. But then you're giving them that collective ownership, and you're creating a space where they can have that conversation, which they would never in a million years have that conversation unless you intervene to enable it. So they came up with their own plan of, okay, we could have meeting-free Fridays, or we can just make our meetings 35 minutes, or we can start with 3 minutes of meditation, or we don't need to copy everybody on every email. You know, whatever their issue is, they will figure out a solution for themselves. So yeah, I agree. I think that co-ownership, the collective responsibility for our collective wellness is absolutely critical.
I'm going to ask you, is there a question that you want to ask the next guest? What's the question you want to ask the next guest? Ryan Anders,
how are you today?
How are you today? I'll let the next guest up. Thank you so much for coming here, Ryan. You're officially my first guest in this conversation, so they're going for all the great work, the community work that you're doing for both genders.
Yes.
And, you know, we're in the beginning of 2024, and I'm looking forward to collaborating with you more, and hopefully this is the beginning of something, right?
Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I'll just leave your audience with, like, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and ask for help when you need it.
Yeah, well, thank you. And you, Spire.